Now let us listen to Ayah 16 of Surah Ahqaf.
أولئك الذين نتقبل عنهم أحسن ما عملوا ونتجاوز عن سيئاتهم في أصحاب الجنة وعد الصدق الذي كانوا يوعدون.
Such are those from whom we accept the best of what they do and overlook their misdeeds, who will be among the inhabitants of paradise, a true promise which they had been given. As is clear, this ayah means to say that being dutiful to parents and doing good to them is a sign of expression of gratitude towards Allah for His bounties and results in the acceptance of good deeds in the Divine Court of the All-Merciful, who forgives the faults one has committed. In other words, the good deeds of the children and even their intentions of doing good to the parents is accepted by God, who gives them better recompense by forgiving sins and the promise of paradise. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, has said, "One who obtains the satisfaction of his parents has gained the satisfaction of God, and one who angers his parents angers God." He also said, "One who wishes to have life prolonged and daily sustenance increased should be good towards parents and provide for the blood relatives." Imam Ali, peace be upon him, the Prophet's vicegerent and the commander of the faithful, has said, "The most significant divine obligation is to do good to parents." This ayah teaches us that, number one, a worthy deed is the one accepted by God. Number two, good deeds towards parents results in forgiveness of sins by God. And number three, serving parents, especially the mother, paves the way towards paradise, in view of God's promise in the Noble Quran and the famous hadith of the Prophet, "Paradise lies at the feet of the mother." Now let us listen to ayahs 17 and 18 of this surah.
والذي قال لوالديه أف لكما أتعدانني أن أخرج وقد خلت القرون من قبلي وهما يستغيثان الله ويلك آمن إن وعد الله حق فيقول ما هذا إلا أساطير الأولين. أولئك الذين حق عليهم القول في أمم قد خلت من قبلهم من الجن والإنس إنهم كانوا خاسرين.
As for him who says to his parents, "Fie on you, do you promise me that I shall be raised from the dead when generations have passed away before me?" And the parents invoke Allah's help and say, "Woe to you! Believe! Indeed Allah's promise is true." But he says, "These are nothing but the myths of the ancients. Such are the ones against whom the word became due concerning the nations that have passed away before them of jinn and humans. They were indeed the losers." Unworthy children are a source of trouble for parents and insult them with such derogatory words as "Fie upon you!" But the compassionate parents seek God's assistance to guide these erratic children and urge them to be virtuous and desist from disbelief, sins, and vices. Here, the reference is to the disbelieving children of God-fearing parents, whose advice to believe in the power of God Almighty at the Day of Judgment falls on deaf ears, to the extent that these erring children say in a mocking tone, "Are you telling us to believe in myths when we have seen generations who died before us could never be raised to life?" In other words, compassionate parents make every attempt to rescue their obdurate children from the abyss of ignorance and the painful torment in afterlife. But the unworthy children persist in their disbelief, and their parents find no other alternative but to leave them to their miserable fate. As Ayah 18 means to say, obdurate disbelievers, whether mankind or the species called jinn or genie, are those against whom the word of divine wrath has passed. And the disbelieving nations before them, they are the permanent losers who will be cast into hell. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, it is a cardinal sin to be disrespectful toward parents. Number two, parental love makes the father and the mother seek God's help for their erring children that have deviated from the right path. Number three, those of the children who realize their fault and seek forgiveness from parents are forgiven by God Almighty as well. And number four, for those who obdurately stick to disbelief by ridiculing the manifest truth, including oneness of God Almighty, the raising of prophets, and the occurrence of the last day for the final judgment, cannot be saved from divine wrath.
Iran Today.
The U.S. pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, or JCPOA, on 8th May 2018. That was under its recently terminated former administration. With Joe Biden taking office as U.S. president, hopes ran high for that joint comprehensive plan of action, which he pledged to re-enter in his election campaign. But now he's ushering Iran to go first, to recommit to its obligations under the deal, so the U.S. would follow by returning to the deal. Oh, but Iran insists, it was you that left the deal. You took the first step out, so you take the first step back, or else.
A December urgency law is to get into action on the 21st of February, and that'll mean the end of free visits for nuclear inspectors to Iran who've been living in this country since the JCPOA of 2015. Unless the new U.S. administration returns to the deal unconditionally. But it looks like Joe Biden is banking on his four terms in office. Alas, action can't wait a full term. I'm Leila Faramazi. So, the Biden administration is now talking of mincing its way back into the deal only after Iran begins recommitting. The deal was between Iran and the UN Security Council permanent members. That's the US, UK, France, Russia, China, and Germany. Under UN Security Council Resolution 2231, the purpose of the deal was to curb Iran's nuclear program in return for lifting UN economic nuclear-related sanctions off this country. Iran complied, as verified 15 times, no less, by the UN's nuclear watchdog, the IAEA. Still, the US pulled out unilaterally and reinstated all UN sanctions as US sanctions. It has been a long-drawn process, and now economic sanctions are practically as good as sanctions on food, health, and medicine. Mr. Mackey is a political analyst who kindly makes the trip to Press TV studios for interviews. We had him on the show yet again.
Given all America's deal-breaking during its former administration, the whole world doesn't trust that country anymore, let alone Iran. So what hope do you see, really, for the revival of the JCPOA?
By signing the JCPOA, the Islamic Republic of Iran has shown that the only solution to the problems and all the challenges that exist in Iran's relations with the West can be resolved through dialogue and negotiation, and that there's no issue that cannot be resolved. It's unlikely for the U.S. to be able to continue pushing its proposals and plans to return to the JCPOA. It's an issue that can be resolved. Making simultaneous and concurrent moves to return to commitments is a logical idea. It's unlikely that the European governments will stay on the U.S. side for long. They will try to lay the groundwork for lifting sanctions and returning to commitments by consulting and negotiating with the parties to the deal.
Iran has come to a point where it refuses to sit and wait for its rights to be thrown at it breadcrumb at a time. So it decided to further exert pressure on Western signatories to the deal to get sanctions lifted once and for all. That is why on December 2, 2020, Parliament proposed the said law, the Strategic Act of the Islamic Consultative Assembly to remove sanctions. Mr. Izadi is professor of American studies. I'm sure you'll find his viewpoint interesting.
The West insists on adding clauses to the JCPOA, such as interference with Iran's regional policy, scrapping its missile program. Where does this stem from? How much might it have to do with our regional rivals?
I think it's U.S. imperialism, basically. The United States wants to dictate its policies towards Iran, whether people in the White House belong to the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. And U.S. allies in the region basically take the lead from the United States. So I think the main problem is the United States. And the fact that Biden administration actually likes what Trump did to Iran, that's a problem.
Our experts say what they think of Iran's strategy of demanding a U.S. return to the deal before Iran recommits to lower levels of uranium enrichment with less advanced centrifuges in only the Natanz nuclear site. But please note, more important than a U.S. return to the deal is the U.S.'s lifting sanctions off this country. A U.S. return without sanctions relief would mean nothing. The Iranian leader's recent speech in response to U.S. policy has triggered Iranian strategy. Mr. Abolfat is an expert on Iran-America relations and an asset to the TV company. Press TV borrows him from time to time.
It appears Iran may have to further pressure other parties to the JCPOA, the Western parties to the JCPOA. What do you think Iran can now do?
Iran has not left the JCPOA. Iran remains a party to this multilateral agreement. Even a year after Donald Trump announced the U.S. withdrawal from the accord, Iran remained fully committed to the JCPOA. And the International Atomic Energy Agency issued periodic reports stating that Iran had fully complied with these obligations. But a year after it became clear that the Americans were not going to live up to their commitments and the Europeans were unable to meet their obligations, the Islamic Republic announced that it was gradually scaling back some of its commitments, while stressing that all those steps were reversible. Tehran said as soon as the other side, that is, the United States and Europe, fulfill their obligations, it will go back into full compliance.
Without sanctions relief, the deal would mean nothing because the whole point of the deal was that Iran show goodwill in proving its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes only, in return for sanctions lifting to encourage foreign trade with Iran, therefore boosting this country's economy. Whereas, never mind industrial or arms imports, even foreign clothes are hard to come by in Iran now.
The fact is that the solution to return to the JCPOA is not complicated. If there is a will to lift the sanctions and return to the JCPOA, it can be done with an executive order from US President Joe Biden. But the Americans have always tried to have the upper hand in negotiations with Iran, even when the blame rests with them.
As a first step in reviving the JCPOA, Iran not only expects sanctions to be lifted before it recommits, it demands to verify U.S. actions before recomplying. The next step would be for the U.S. to compensate this country and its trade partners. Compensate for the damage Donald Trump's sanctions have done us and companies that suffered secondary sanctions for dealing with Iran. The unilateral U.S. sanctions are deemed illegal by experts at large, by the way.
As Parliament prepares to vote, I await my interviewee MP, whom I'll be bringing to you shortly with his viewpoint.
It's the Parliamentary Deputy Speaker, Mr. Ghazizadeh Hashemi, I bring you.
We expect that after all these years that we showed unilateral tolerance, Americans will live up to their commitments. First, they need to prove that they are trustworthy and spout off after. The Americans, whether the Democratic Obama, whose vice president was Mr. Biden, or the Republican Trump, are unreliable to us and must act to gain our trust. It's that simple.
Another MP I got to talk to is Mr. Rastine. It's his first tenure, but he appears to possess the passion to attempt long strides in any amount of time given.
Time is running out to salvage the JCPOA, that they call a landmark international deal. We are days away from the end of the deal. The U.S. and European countries should try and prize these remaining days by returning to their commitments, removing all sanctions, and facilitating the return of all the frozen assets of Iran to Tehran. Otherwise, the Islamic Republic of Iran has shown that it insists on the implementation of the Parliament's resolution.
We wrote the law to lift the sanctions according to Article 36 of the JCPOA, because the same law allows us to suspend some of our commitments if the West doesn't honor its obligations. We are still a party to the deal. We haven't withdrawn our participation from it. They need to carry out their commitments, so we do ours.
Now, while Iran proposes more for more, the U.S. is mincing in with an offer or demand of less for less. And Iran's said law may be their excuse for this, whereas Iran's law is a reaction to the U.S. pullout and the EU's lack of commitment to the deal to begin with. The E3 are the UK, France and Germany. They pledged to safeguard Iran's interests against the US pullout by enacting an updated blocking statute on 7th August 2018 to nullify US sanctions on countries trading with Iran.
This was followed by a couple of trade mechanisms, finally known as INSTEX, Instrument in Support of Trade Exchanges. But nothing worked in the face of U.S. belligerence and European lack of will. Europe has, for its part, been trying to inch in with new demands to an already agreed deal, say, curbing Iran's regional presence and scrapping its ballistic missile program, when the deal was solely to supervise and control Iran's nuclear activity. But that backfired.
I said the West strategy had backfired. Asking for more has meant getting less.
Iran's parliament has passed a law, and I think the executive branch will follow that law. Iran has a peaceful nuclear program. There is no reason for Iran to follow every restraint on its nuclear program that is under the nuclear agreement, because the other side is not following it. So Iran will continue its peaceful activities. under NPT.
Now, what does Iran's said law exactly comprise? This policy of maximum or wise resistance manifested in maximum pressure on the U.S. and the international community. It's inked in a range of arenas. While aiming to get all sanctions on Iran lifted with Iran compensated for damages, it demands Iran's nuclear accomplishments to date be leveraged.
Iran has started enriching uranium to 20% purity. Iran has taken major step in the production of metallic uranium, and the deadline for the implementation of a parliament resolution is imminent. So Iran has chosen maximum resistance and maximum retaliation against their maximum pressure.
But so far, these Iranian measures haven't been enough. Our MP gives us an example of how far Iran might next go to exert further pressure on the West.
Certainly, the Islamic Republic will end the additional cooperation with the IAEA based on this resolution. This means that the additional protocol, which is a set of extra rules setting Iran's diplomatic, technical, and scientific relations with the IAEA, will surely expire, and Iran will end the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol.
No one can trust the United States. The experience of negotiations and talks with Washington over the past decade has shown that the Americans are highly unreliable and have to be spoken to with distrust.
Our narrative still goes on, but let's give a chance to other media outlets for a bit to see what they have to say on the issue. And what would be our other media outlets of the day? Newsweek and Ausat. Newsweek tells of how Iran is going to replace the West, possibly. Iran courts China-Russia as new nuclear deal with declining U.S. storms. Iranian officials are continuing to build stronger ties with Russia and China as Tehran faces what could be a prolonged standoff with President Joe Biden over any possible revival of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, or nuclear deal. Biden is demanding that Iran scale back its nuclear program in line with JCPOA restrictions before American sanctions are lifted. However, Iranian leaders have said they will not return to compliance until the U.S. eases sanctions and does the same. Tehran is casting around for allies to help offset American pressure, along with the threat from regional U.S. allies like Israel and Saudi Arabia. Russia and China have repeatedly spoken out against Trump's withdrawal from the deal and have urged Biden to recommit to the accord with no conditions. In recent weeks, Tehran has been lauding ties with both countries as the nuclear issue remains stalled. Now, French President Macron has offered to broker talks with Israel and Saudi Arabia present, and Ausat refers exactly to that. Iran snubs Macron's offer to mediate Washington-Tehran nuclear talks. Tehran has rejected French President Emmanuel Macron's offer to be an honest broker in talks between Iran and the U.S. The nuclear deal has no need for a mediator, Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh told reporters, without specifically mentioning France. But in response to a question about recent comments by the country's president, Khatibzadeh also insisted that there was no need to renegotiate the nuclear deal. When a document is written with such precision and length, it means it is not necessary to discuss it again. It is all there in more than 150 pages, he said, of the deal officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The spokesman added that European states must themselves return to their commitments under the nuclear deal with Iran. Newsweek tells of how an Iranian commander has shown Iran doesn't have to be passive. Iran commander tells U.S. take a lesson from military drills amid nuclear deal standoff. The commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, IRGC, is celebrating the service's most recent military drills, saying the U.S. and other enemies should take a lesson from the firepower on display. IRGC Commander Major General Hossein Salami told reporters that the Great Prophet military exercises held last week, beginning February the 9th, in Iran's southwestern province of Khuzestan, showcased the service's authority, defense, resistance, and aggression, according to Mehr News Agency. The ground forces of the IRGC guarantee our security, independence, honor, and dignity, and they shone brightly in their latest war game, Salami said, on the sidelines of the drill. The enemy should take a lesson from the firepower showcased by Iranian forces, he added, a reference to the U.S. and regional enemies like Israel and Saudi Arabia. So that's it for the news segment. Do stay with me for the continuation of our own narrative.
There's more to Iran's December law. It also demands the blockade of European initiatives to include the issue of Iran's ballistic missile development, enriching uranium to a high level, 20%, enriching uranium using advanced generation centrifuges, the passage in Majlis of Parliament of legislation for non-cooperation with the UN nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, and expulsion of its inspectors. More demands coming up in a bit.
The message of the Parliament's strategic action to the United States was that one cannot claim they adhere to the rule of law and maintain favorable diplomatic relations, all the while disrupting the international law with their inappropriate and destructive behavior.
Iran's maximum resistance policy further demands, in the ballistic missile arena, using the launch of satellites into space as civilian scientific activity to demonstrate Iran's capability in producing long-range missiles. In the conventional military arena, shows of conventional strength by conducting extensive military exercises to include the use of advanced suicide drones. In the political arena, it insists on all-out diplomatic pressure to safeguard Iran's nuclear program, which is a national project agreed by all the country's institutions.
Looking at the situation from Tehran, you realize that being flexible with the Americans is the most stupid thing that you can do, because they don't value cooperation, so Iran is not going to make the same mistake that Iran did with the Obama administration, basically trusting the American government to continue its commitments after an administration has finished.
And why is Iran so adamant in combating sanctions and strengthening its position? A look at sanctions imposed on this country after the U.S. trashed the JCPOA in May 2018 should suffice to answer that. They almost immediately began in November 2018. To summarize, in September 2019, a U.S. official stated that the United States will sanction whoever deals with Iran or purchases its oil. Also in September 2019, new sanctions targeted the Iranian National Bank. On 21st February 2020, Iran was placed on the FATF blacklist. FATF being the Financial Action Task Force, an intergovernmental organization for combating money laundering. Next, the U.S. proposed to extend the global arms embargo on Iran, but the United Nations Security Council rejected that resolution. Hence, the U.S. moved to unilaterally trigger snapback sanctions, although it had walked away from the Iran nuclear deal and no longer had logical, legitimate claim on it.
It seems the Biden administration, it doesn't know if they like the Trump administration policies towards Iran or not. It seems that they criticize Trump a lot, but they actually like Trump policies towards Iran, and they want to keep those policies, and they keep talking about leverage. They like leverage, which means they like sanctions.
In September 2020, then-President Trump imposed sweeping new sanctions on Iran to curb its missile and conventional arms programs. On the 8th of October 2020, the U.S. targeted 18 Iranian banks.
Question is, why this pursuit of a maximum pressure policy when it has failed? The goal was basically to bring Iran to its knees by bringing its oil exports down to zero, whereas those exports have slowly but steadily only increased, after a serious low, of course, since the U.S.'s harshest ever sanctions.
And now oil analysts foresee an additional 500,000 Iranian oil barrels coming back on the market in the next 2 to 3 months, possibly with U.S. approval.
The intensification of sanctions is no longer a major concern for Iran, because there are no more sanctions left to be imposed now. Even if the Europeans want to join the United States in introducing sanctions, there is nothing left to boycott. As a result, sanctions as a tool has lost its function against Iran.
The revolution's leaders' take on the matter pretty much sums it all up. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said in reference to former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton and his boss Donald Trump, one of those first-rate fools said they would celebrate New Year 2019 in Tehran. That person has been sent to history's trash can, and his boss has also been kicked out of the White House with disgrace. But the Islamic Republic is still standing on its feet with God's grace. The nuclear deal was to control Iran's nuclear program and none else. But for argument's sake, Foreign Minister Zarif said, when Iran has no nuclear weapons, talk about missiles with nuclear warheads is meaningless. Secondly, the parties to the JCPOA, whose annual sales of weapons to the region have amounted to over $100 billion, are in no position to tell Iran to forgo its missile defenses. The Europeans and Americans should know that we will not discuss what has already been resolved. This would be against the rules of negotiation.
That's it for today. Thanks for watching from the whole team. The episode has come to an end, but remember, the show goes on. Bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to the debate. I'm Andrew Snyder. The only proper way to resolve the deadlock over the Iran nuclear deal is Washington's return to it. That's what China believes is the solution to the deadlock. Russia has already shared an identical viewpoint. Tehran insists it was Washington that abandoned the JCPOA in 2018, so that's the party to take the first step if it ever wishes to go back, as claimed by President Biden. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has asserted that the Islamic Republic has had enough of lip service. Tehran is now awaiting action by Washington, which means the removal of all sanctions reimposed on the Islamic Republic under the Trump administration.
The fate of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal still remains uncertain. The United States says Iran should first come back to full compliance with the accord. Tehran, however, argues that it was Washington that walked away from the international accord and hence it should first fulfill all its obligations, including the lifting of sanctions against the Islamic Republic. Now China has once again called on the U.S. to return to the deal, known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, saying it is the only proper way to resolve the deadlock over the issue.
China always believes that the U.S. return to the JCPOA is the only way to resolve the deadlock in the Iran nuclear issue. All parties should feel the urgency to work together to implement the consensus reached during the Foreign Ministers' Conference on the Iran nuclear issue in last December, and urge the U.S. side to return to the JCPOA unconditionally as soon as possible while lifting all sanctions against Iran.
Meanwhile, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani said the new U.S. administration needs to act swiftly to make up for Washington's past mistakes and return to the rule of law. Rouhani stressed that the Iranian nation will never bow to U.S. bullying. On Wednesday, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said what Tehran wants to see from the other parties to the nuclear deal is action, not words.
که در عمل اون حرفا و بعدها نقض شده و ضدش عمل شده. هر فایده نداره، وعده فایده نداره. این دفعه فقط عمل، عمل، عمل از طرف مقابل. ببینیم ما هم عمل خواهیم کرد.
The new U.S. President Joe Biden has signaled a willingness to rejoin the JCPOA, but his administration has conditioned the move on Tehran's resumption of its commitments. Tehran has repeatedly said it will accept no precondition for the return of the United States to the agreement. Iran recently announced that it has decided to suspend the snap inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency. Officials said the move would be in line with the Iranian parliament's recent legislation called the Strategic Action Plan to Counter Sanctions. Tehran, however, noted that the decision does not mean ending all IAEA inspections of its nuclear facilities. In reaction, the UN nuclear watchdog said its director, Rafael Mariano Grossi, will travel to Iran to discuss the issue. After the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in May 2018, Iran waited for a year and gave leeway to the European signatories to the deal to make up for the U.S. pullout. They, however, failed to live up to their commitments, prompting Tehran to scale back on its commitments under the accord. However, Iran has time and again said that their measures are fully reversible upon full compliance by the remaining signatories. Now questions arise as whether the Biden administration will follow the path of its predecessor against Iran or try to rectify the Trump-era policy against Iran, which has been described as a failed approach even by some of Washington's closest allies.
Okay, that was a report by Mehdi Farahman. Let me invite our guest to this show. We'll have Executive Director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, Daniel McAdams, in Lake Jackson, Texas. And also author of The Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, Gareth Porter, who is joining us out of Arlington, Virginia. Good to have both of you on the show, gentlemen. Let's go to Daniel. China and Russia have echoed Iran's stance as to the U.S. return to the accord. What would you advise the Biden administration do, if you could? And let's not forget the fact that Iran is still under a so-called most severe sanctions that have been in place by the Trump administration, known as the Maximum Pressure Campaign.
Well, President Biden's administration has had a full month now to revise its Trump's failed policy. Maximum pressure has been a maximum failure. There has not been much action. And in fact, you know, I think they're sort of tied into a corner right now. You have some strong statements by Anthony Blinken, who talks about the need for Iran to return to the deal first. Whereas, of course, as your report pointed out, as everyone knows, it was President Trump of the United States that pulled out of the deal. The net result of this whole thing really is the U.S. is losing stature as a good actor in the world stage. If you can't keep your deals, if you can't keep your bargains, then nobody will deal with you in the future. So this is a problem for the Biden administration. There doesn't seem they don't seem to be moving in the right direction.
Gareth, on Wednesday, Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei said that what Tehran wants from Washington is, I'm quoting him, action, not words, over the nuclear deal. And we have heard many nice words and promises, which in practice have been broken, and even opposite actions have been taken. Now, does Iran have good reasons to distrust the U.S. intentions and policies?
I think it's a fair statement to make that Iran does have good reason to distrust American statements about this entire issue. And really, one has to go back some years, if not decades, and understand the origins of this situation, which is that the U.S. government, going back not just to the Trump administration or even to the Obama administration, but previous to that, had a strategy of really trying to coerce Iran to bow down to U.S. demands with regard to its nuclear program, and this was, in fact, a fundamental sort of principle of operation of the U.S. in international affairs during and after the Cold War, which was to establish a hierarchy of power, a clear hierarchy in which the United States would be calling the shots and smaller, weaker states would have to buckle under to the U.S. diktat. And so I think what we've seen in recent years is a continuation of that situation where the United States expected that it could somehow continue to impose its will on Iran. And the JCPOA was certainly to a great extent a departure from that, because at the beginning, let's face it, the United States believed that it had the wherewithal to force Iran to essentially give up its nuclear program, to have no enrichment. That was the demand that President Obama was making as late as 2012. And when the negotiations began, he soon began to realize that he wasn't going to be able to enforce that. And so the process of making concessions to Iran and its rights began. And I think the final result bears that out, without going into more detail. But I think we have to recognize that the Biden administration now is continuing this practice, this belief, if you will, that the United States can and must impose its will on Iran by pressure, by having leverage on Iran. Mm-hmm. And that means that it must somehow rely on the Trump administration's sanctions against mm-hmm. Iran, which are the strongest sanctions the United States has ever brought to bear against Iran. And that is why I think it's clear the Trump administration is not ready to go back to the JCPOA at this point and wants to continue to try to exercise that leverage.
Right. Now, Danielle, the Biden administration's public stance is that it will only lift sanctions on Iran if the country reduces the activity of its civilian program to the JCPOA limits. But it was the U.S. that violated the agreement, and Tehran wants Washington to act first. U.S. took the first step out. Now we should take the first step in. Now, is Iran asking for too much?
Well, I think they're both publicly making strong stances and seemingly intractable, but I think we've seen some indications. There have been kind of a flurry of diplomacy. There have been the involvement of third-party actors this past week. Merkel spoke to Rouhani, I think it was yesterday, and there have been a couple of similar conversations. Remember, we are on the cusp of the Munich International Security Conference, where President Biden is supposed to speak tomorrow, scheduled to speak tomorrow. So if he, in fact, remembers where he is when he's speaking or what he's talking about, there is some possibility that he might make mention of the JCPOA in some way. But in your report, you quoted Khamenei as talking about what we need to see action. But he also said, if we see action from the other side, we will take action as well. So I think there's an indication of some ability to move. People have talked about some kind of a phased return to the JCPOA with the EU as kind of a broker. So I think there are more possibilities, there are more things on the table than it may seem when you simply listen to the rhetoric of both sides.
Now, Gareth, the issue of distrust is a very serious one as far as Iran is concerned, and you know very well about Iran. You have written books about it. And the U.S. signed this multilateral UN-backed deal with Iran and then simply left it after a short while. Then it even threatened the remaining signatories not to stick to their commitments as per the deal. So how can Iran trust the same wouldn't happen again?
Well, I think Iran must trust the United States to be the United States. I think that's the problem. That it must have a realistic appraisal of the way the United States operates and an understanding of the psychological and political origins of the strategies and tactics that the United States practices diplomatically in regard to smaller states, states that do not have the same degree of power that the United States has. And at one time, as you know very well, and as your viewers know very well, the United States relied on the threat of military force as its primary source of leverage or pressure against Iran. And now it's very clear the United States recognizes that is not going to work. It is no longer possible to rely on the threat of war against Iran because Iran has too much power to resist and to essentially impose real serious costs on the United States and its allies in the region. So now they are relying entirely on their economic sanctions and specifically the ability to deny Iran the ability to trade, to sell its oil, which is the mainstay of its national budget. And so I think it's much more fundamental here. I'm not nearly as optimistic as I think Dan has suggested he is at this point, that there is a lot of room here for negotiation. I think there's going to have to be a much more fundamental shift in the nature of thinking about Iran on the part of the Biden administration in order to get somewhere in the zone of real negotiation. And I must say that the people who have now moved into the primary positions of policymaking in the Biden administration are not people who've impressed me as really very flexible in their thinking. So I'm relatively pessimistic at this point about an early resolution or even a beginning of resolution of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Now, Daniel, before taking office, President Biden pledged to work with Iran to restore the JCPOA, but so far his administration has failed to act. What do you think is the reason for this failure?
Well, Biden ran as the anti-Trump, and now is certainly on foreign policy. But now that he's in office, he is basically, you know, continuing the worst of Trump's policies, and in terms of continued sanctions against Venezuela, continued dedication to regime change in Syria. Whereas I think Trump lost a little bit of stomach for these Middle East adventures, even with, you know, a few of his infractions. But he is continuing this idea of a sanctions regime, and I think Gareth is right. And by the way, I've just tried to sound optimistic. I'm not that optimistic. But I think, as Gareth said, there are so many people in that have gone into the administration who spent these last 4 years in very provocative positions with regard to Syria, with regard to regime change, with regard to Iran, that it does make you wonder. So many people from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy have gone into the administration and other various AIPAC-oriented think tanks, that you can't really be too optimistic, even as I try to be. But, you know, trying to read the tea leaves as to what might be happening, you do notice some sort of neocon chatter. And, I mean, I hate to sort of rely on this, but they're even dragging out old Reza Pahlavi. You know, once again, they're dusting him off to warn, don't you dare go back into the JCPOA. Biden, it's so dangerous, and this sort of thing. So you're seeing neocons, you're seeing a lot of U.S. representatives, and of course the war and war threatening is the lifeblood of Washington, but they're coming out and threatening Biden, and I'm just wondering, are they nervous and how nervous are they, and that might that be an indication that Biden is about to perhaps take some moves in the positive direction.
Now let me ask Gareth for some more explanation on the point that he's not so optimistic regarding what President Biden promised during the electoral campaign. So is it only the people around him, Gareth, or what?
Well, I think it's primarily the people that he's named to be Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, who are people who are really hardliners on issues that relate to this problem. And I feel that they are not inclined in any near-term view to be flexible. They're not simply sort of voicing threats that they're hoping Iran will now suddenly respond to with their own sort of making concessions so that they can then shift into a different mode. I feel like that they're taking a stand that is more fundamental here, and it's extremely dangerous. Let's be clear about this. I think it is dangerous. But it does reflect a set of expectations, a set of values. And on the other side of the picture, or part of this picture, is the domestic political structure of the United States, which is so strongly dominated by right-wing extremist views on Iran. And I think that Biden himself and his advisors, his key national security officials, are very sensitive to that domestic political context as well. So it's an additional factor that leads me to feel relatively pessimistic about short-term sort of progress in the direction of diplomatic resolution.
Okay. Now, Daniel, let's take a look at the EU in the middle of all of this. And the European signatories to the nuclear deal, they have always insisted the deal must be preserved. But, you know, in action, they have failed to fulfill their commitments under that accord. They have been accusing even Iran of not sticking to it. And how do you see the European side of the deal's behavior and role?
Well, the Europeans have made a decision to de facto pull out of the deal themselves after the U.S. did, and after people like John Bolton exerted pressure on them to do so. They haven't shown a lot of backbone or a lot of spine when it comes to this, but that really shouldn't be shocking because we're talking about the EU here, especially EU foreign policy, which tends to be Washington's lapdog. But I don't think that doesn't mean that they have a role to play here. I don't think that they wanted the deal to go sour, unlike President Trump did. I think they want to be in the deal. Certainly the Germans had experienced the positive effects of the deal with the renewal of trade relations with Iran and a lot of money changing hands. So I think they want it to go forward. I think they have a role to play. I think they can play a role of some sort of slow walking back the sanctions. And you know, but I think at the end of the day, the Iranians have a lot more, are holding a lot more cards in Washington right now, even though, of course, there's a disparity in military power. The Iranians have announced that they are, on, I think, February 23rd, going to pull out of the voluntary additional protocols, which allows snap inspections from the IAEA. They have so many moves that they can make and continue to make with, I think, a pretty good guess that Washington is not about to go to war as they do these things. There are several more moves they can make. There really aren't a lot of more moves that Washington can make at this point. So I think the Iranians are actually in pretty good position vis-a-vis Washington on this.
Okay. Now, Garrett, Daniel talked about the EU's role in this. Now, what about the role of Israel in this process?
The Israelis are playing the same role that they have in the past, or at least attempting to play that role, of putting pressure on the White House to hew to essentially Israeli interests by essentially not going ahead with any serious negotiations that would result in making concessions to Iran on their nuclear program. That hasn't changed at all. If anything, the Israeli government has hardened its posture in recent days, and we see, you know, the prime minister essentially naming somebody to deal with the United States and other countries on this issue who knows nothing about it, and who is simply going to be following Netanyahu's own orders almost day by day. But I don't think that Israel has the same degree of clout that it did, you know, some years ago. I think it's been shown that they cannot control U.S. policy, that U.S. Policy toward Iran is effectively driven by domestic U.S. interests or interests that whatever administration in power has in regard to the issue. Now, that was not particularly true of the Trump administration, where you had special, you obviously had special relationship between Trump and the Israelis, which had a monetary character because of his reliance on pro-Israeli financiers to fund his election campaigns. But I think now we have a situation where Israel does not have the kind of clout that it had under Trump, and even less than it had, I think, during the Obama administration.
Okay. On that note, we come to the end of this debate show. Thanking my guests and the